Okay, let's go back to Ezekiel chapter 3, verse 26. And I will make your tongue cleave to the roof of your mouth, that you shall be dumb, unable to speak. And you shall not be to them a reprover. Why? For they are a rebellious house. So if you're silent, you can't reprove. And he doesn't want them to reprove them because they're rebellious. Now, this silence is not a complete or absolute silence. Because from time to time, God would speak to him and would permit him to give the message to the Jews. And that's why he says in verse 27, he qualifies it. But when I speak with you, I will open your mouth and you shall say unto them. So, but other than those instances, he is to be dumb or silent. Why? Because he's God's mouthpiece. And so he's representing, in a sense, how God feels about them. Basically, he doesn't have a lot to say. And when he does say something, it's not really what they want to hear. All because of the place that they have put themselves in. So when Ezekiel spoke, it was only because God had something to say at the moment. Otherwise, he was silent because God was silent. And God had nothing to say, thank you. Therefore, he represents Jesus Christ, who spoke only what the Father gave him to speak. We read, for example, in John chapter 12 and verse 49, he says, the Father has given me commandment, what I should speak, what I should say. And other scriptures talk about the Father that is in me. He is speaking. It is his words, his works. So when Jesus talked, I don't know if we can take this statement in an absolute sense. I think there were times that he just chatted with kids, that he wasn't thundering, thus saith the Lord. But you know what I mean. In his ministerial capacity, okay, when he took his rabbinical hat off and sat down to chow with the disciples, I think personally that he could talk about the weather too. I don't think he spent years and years majoring on meteorology, but I think that he was a man, and I think that he, not every word was just, you know, a loudspeaker connected to God's throne. I could be wrong, but that's what I think. However, knowing the nature of his ministry, again, I think that he was a man of sorrows, well acquainted with grief, and he was given to be God's oracle or mouthpiece to the world. So I think he was a lot different than probably all of our concepts, you know, when taken separately, put together, or any combination thereof. But the point is, in his ministerial capacity, when he spoke, it was because God was speaking, because God wanted something to say something, and therefore he was translating it, or not translating it, but giving it to the people as his spokesman. So, here we have an imposed silence. First of all, we have an imposed house arrest. I don't like the word arrest, I guess. It makes it sound like Ezekiel's done something wrong. Let us say restriction. He's on restriction to his house. And now we have a restriction on his speech. Restriction on his movements, restriction on his speech. Why? Again, to tell the people something, just like the first one would tell them. I'm bound in my house because you bound me in my heart. You bound the word of God in my heart by your unwillingness. Now, this imposed silence is another rebuke to the people. They've rejected God's prophets, so God, and remember, Ezekiel represents God in the sense that he's God's mouthpiece, so God's going to ignore them. You won't listen to me, you ignore me, so I'm going to ignore you. So the man ministers by not talking. A lot can be said with silence, if you know what I mean. The sounds of silence, just nothing, can, in a certain context and in a certain vein, say worlds of things. Really, that's the worst form of judgment. Perhaps you have witnessed the proverbial spat between lovers or husband and wife when they've been arguing over something, you know, it's too bad. And then it gets to the point where one chooses to ignore the other one. That's usually when it gets more heated. Because as long as the person is still talking, even if they don't like what they're saying necessarily or they're not agreeing with it, at least they're still on talking terms. But when the other one turns on heel and walks away and there's that stony wall of silence, that's the worst form of what word is I'm looking for here, but snub. And that's when people usually really get upset, and the demons in them get real upset too. So the Lord is saying, I'm not even going to talk to you anymore. That'll really get people to get either angry or repentant and really think about it, that he wouldn't even talk to him anymore, basically. But it's really going to make him do something, isn't it? It's going to force him to do something rather than continuing to dialogue with them, continuing to, you know, just kind of talk and talk and talk, and they're really basically not listening. There's a principle, I think, here for us in our witnessing, too, and in our ministering to people, counseling, so forth. Just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk. There's a time to not talk anymore. There's a time to say, that's it. Now what are you going to do? That's it. We read in 1 Samuel 3:1 that there was a whole era in which God basically had nothing to say to his people. It was during the time right before Samuel, the prophet, from the period of sin during the certain period during the judges up through Samuel's day. Says the word of the Lord was scarce, and there was no open vision, 1 Samuel 3:1. And so they weren't getting much from the Lord. He had very little or nothing to say, and it was very significant that he had nothing to say, because the people were in such sin, every man doing that which is right in his own sight, that the Lord said, I'm not going to waste my breath on him. I'm not going to give him the time of day. But I'm doing this, even what I'm doing, because I love him, because this should be something that should wake them up. But when the people of God have no oracle of God anymore, when Israel has no open vision, no well-known vision is how some translate that, I think. And then in chapter 7 and verse 2 of 1 Samuel, it says that when the ark was in Kirjath-Jearim for 20 years, the people mourned after Yahweh. So it may have kind of brought them around a little bit, because it was away from them. Remember, the ark represents God's presence, God's oracle. So when it was away from them for two decades, they began to miss him a little bit. Also, we read in Amos chapter 8, verses 11 and 12, that there's going to be a famine for hearing the words of the Lord. In the end, it would be so easy to take the things of God for granted. You know, the old saying, familiarity breeds contempt. It doesn't have to, but sometimes it does. And it can be so easy to take our pastor for granted, the eldership for granted, the Bible college for granted, the church services for granted, the Word of God that's so abundant for granted. What if it goes someday? What if God quits talking to us someday? What if some of these things leave us or something happens? Now, but God did speak to them once in a while. As I say, it was not an absolute silence. It almost was, but it wasn't totally. Otherwise, we wouldn't have much of a book here. The book would pretty much end right here. In chapter 11, verse 25, he says, I spake unto them. So there's an example. Also in chapter 14, verses 1 through 6, he speaks to the elders, gives them a rebuke. Also in chapter 20, verse 1 and following, there's another rebuke. But again, this is not only the love of God, but I would furthermore say the mercy of God. Because if they're not going to listen anyway, for God to talk to them more and give them more light is only going to result in more judgment upon them in the end. That's I think, the principle of casting your pearls before swine, not casting your pearls before swine. If somebody's not going to listen, don't pack it down their throat. Why give them more judgment? Don't say a word. Just let it go. There's a time to speak, and there's a time to be silent, as we read in Ecclesiastes chapter 3 and verse 7. And I have found it easier to know when the time to speak is than the time to be silent in my own life. I don't know about you. Also in Hosea chapter 4 and verse 17, God said to Hosea concerning Israel or Ephraim, he says, Ephraim is joined to idols. Let him alone. Let him alone. Hosea 4:17, kind of like Paul saying to deliver such an one to the destruction for to Satan for the destruction of the flesh, that the soul may be saved in the day of the Lord. Also, we read in Proverbs 9:7 that he that reproves a scorner shall get a shame to himself, and he shall be hated. Proverbs 9:7. I've seen unwise Christians reprove scorners, and they're going to give them the word of the Lord anyway. Now, out of love. You know, although not always brought with love, but out of a motive of love, but overzealous and so forth, wrong, it's wrong. And it hurts the gospel, and they just get shame upon themselves and so forth. doesn't do any good. And it's not hiding your light. It's just being wise as serpents and harmless as doves. Verse 27, but when I speak with thee, I will open your mouth. And as I said, this vow of silence, or this period of silence, goes to the siege of Jerusalem. Then, after the destruction of the city, God again releases him and gives him permission to speak freely without having to wait until the Lord gives him a word. We see in chapter 24, verse 27, he says, in that day his mouth was opened. Well, it doesn't say that. I'm rephrasing it now. But in that day, the day that someone who escaped from the destruction of Jerusalem, a Jew, and he made his way into Babylon, and he came to Ezekiel, and he gave him the news. The city has fallen. And in that very day, his mouth was opened, and he was no more dumb. Also, chapter 33, verse 22. And he's to say, thus saith the Lord God. And then he that heareth, I don't think is what Ezekiel is pictured as saying. This is what God's saying now, what the result will be. But thus saith the Lord, and then whatever the message would be that the Lord would give him. And then the Lord says, he that hears, let him hear. He that forbears, let him forbear. In other words, you don't worry about how they're going to react, Ezekiel. Kind of the same thing about don't be afraid of them. You've done your part. If you open your mouth when I put words in it and say, thus saith the Lord, and bring those words, then he who rejects that word does so at his own peril. You ever seen those signs? Caution, swim at own risk. No lifeguard on duty, you know. Well, caution, reject at own risk, because you've rejected the lifeguard. Revelation, it says, he who is unjust, let him be unjust still. Revelation 22:11. All right, chapter 4. Let's begin by reading the first three verses as a whole. Thou also, son of man, take thee a tile. So he's going to stay in his house. He's basically not going to talk, but he's still going to minister to them, and this is how he's going to do it. Take a tile, lay it before you, and portray upon it the city, even Jerusalem, and lay siege against it, and build a fort against it, and cast a mount against it. Set the camp also against it, and set battering rams against it round about. Moreover, take thou unto thee an iron pan, and set it for a wall of iron between you and the city, and set your face against it, and it shall be besieged, and thou shalt lay siege against it. This shall be a sign to the house of Israel. Now this tile was either referring to a clay brick that they used in their buildings, because in Mesopotamia they did not have heavily wooded forests to use for lumber, and they did not have a lot of even rocks to use for stone walls and so forth. But they had a clay in the soil, and so they would make these clay bricks and dry them in a furnace, or dry them by the sun, and then they would use them for their building. So either he used this, or he used a clay tile, or what we call a clay tablet, that they used for writing. One or the other. But in any case, it was something that was, before it was hardened, it was soft enough that he could work with it and make a model out of it. Now he said, lay it before thee. Probably, this is my opinion, he did this outside the front door of his house. He's still basically in his house or at his house. But outside the front door of the house, crowds could gather and see it. And that, of course, is the whole purpose for this. He's not saying, all right, let's make models for fun and profit now. But he's doing it as a ministry, and the people are going to watch him. Okay? Now, portray... In your translations, how does it spell portray? P-O-U-R. You've got the Thompson chain, don't you? Okay, I've got the King James Version too, but it's a different edition apparently, because it's made by Zondervan, and it's got P-O-R. I have found over the years in teaching classes, and then I'll spell a word from the King James, and they say, no, ours is a little bit different. There are different editions of the King James Bible that are out being published by different publishers, and they don't tell you which edition. They haven't numbered them or anything like that. The thing's been revised dozens of times over the years, and this is one of the evidences of it. Mine just says P-O-R, the American spelling of it, And P-O-U-R is the old anglicized or English form of portray. But it's the same. You can drop the U. It's P-O-R-T-R-A-Y as we would spell it today. So he's going to take this tile anyway, and he's going to either draw or engrave the outline of the city of Jerusalem on this large rectangular brick. Now, some of these, if it's a brick, some of these bricks were up to a foot wide by 2 feet long. So that's long enough to, you know, to make a model of the city of Jerusalem on it, drawn or engraved or somehow portrayed. So about a foot, maybe by 2 feet. And lay siege against it. In other words, pretend you're an enemy army and you're coming against the city of Jerusalem. It's pretty obvious what he's going to be portraying, isn't it? The siege of Jerusalem by the Babylonian armies. And build a fort against it. A fort apparently refers to a chain of offensive towers that were built around a besieged city by the besiegers. Example here, 2 Kings chapter 25 and verse 1. And I think they would fight from these towers. Offensive towers. So it's not a fort like we think of it. And then he says, and cast a mount against it. The Hebrew is mound with a D. And it refers to a rampart of earth that would be heaped up outside the wall of the city so that the besiegers could get up higher on the walls. In some cases, in order to try to scale the wall, to go over and get in it. Or in other cases, just to get up higher so that they could find a weak place in the wall and bring their battering rams against it and batter it until they could make a hole in it. Because walls, for obvious reasons, would be thicker, up to, you know, human head height, where most people would be coming against them. So they'd get up higher where the walls were thinner. And they would pile them on a timber framework sometimes, pile earth on top of it, and then make a rampart or mound. So he's making all this then, making it look like the city of Jerusalem is under attack. Verse 3, moreover, take thou unto thee an iron pan, or you could translate it iron plate. Now, we're not sure exactly what this represents, but any one of three things. It may represent the strong defenses of Jerusalem. There's no doubt about it. Jerusalem was a tremendously fortified city. In fact, this final siege lasted from about 588 to 586 BC, some 18 months, year and a half. It took Nebuchadnezzar's tremendous armies to get through the city. Or, second of all, it could represent the impenetrable wall of the besieging army, so that it would be showing the strength of the enemy, not the strength of Jerusalem. Because, see, the Jews who were locked up in the city might try to escape. Some of them did. But they would find an impenetrable wall. They couldn't get through the besiegers. Or, it may represent something in a more spiritual sense, the barrier that now is between God and the Jews because of their sin. It has separated them from God. And so there's like an iron plate between. So, in this little scenario, in this acted out play, Ezekiel then is representing Babylon and or God, because remember, God is sending the army against Judah because of their sins, besieging the city. That's why in verse 2 he said, lay siege against it. So the people are going to be watching this now. And he says, set your face against it, and it shall be besieged, and you shall lay siege against it. And then he tells them why he's going to do this. This shall be a sign to the house of Israel. This shows us that Ezekiel literally did this. He literally performed these actions. And I point that out because some of the commentators claim that this all happened in a vision. But see, if it happened in a vision, how could it be assigned to them? I suppose you could say, well, once he would relate the vision to them. But he's dumb. Remember, he's not supposed to speak until God opens his mouth. So the only way it could be assigned to them, wouldn't it be assigned to them if God shows it to him in a vision and then he doesn't tell them what God showed him? The only way it could be assigned to them is if he actually did it. So he did it, and it would be a sign signifying that this is actually going to happen one day to the city of Jerusalem. So it's a prophecy, just as much as if he said, thus saith the Lord, in 6 years the city of Jerusalem shall be besieged by a strong army, and they shall be defeated because of their sins, because of your sins. But this way, but now he's going to just show it happening instead. You know the old saying, a picture is worth a thousand words. Now, this is the first of a series of prophetic deeds, as opposed to prophetic utterances, of the prophet Ezekiel. He will also be eating what is called the food of affliction. We are also going to be seeing him lying first on his left side and then on his right side for a number of days. Also, we're going to see him shave the hair of his head. And then he's going to take part of the hair and burn it. Then he's going to hide some of the hair in the folds of his garment. And it's all going to be representing things that are happening, going to be happening to the Jews. Then he's going to be called by God to remove all the furniture from his house by night. Now, these seem to be strange actions, you know, to us. They really do. We're not called by God to do these kinds of things, and probably wouldn't be, although I say probably. I've learned never to say never, but you learn some things along the way. But it's in a sense because God's words are no longer heeded by the people. So he's moved on to actions, which would hopefully make a deeper impression. You know, sometimes talking to your children doesn't do much good anymore. You've got to give them some actions. There have to be something there that makes a little bit deeper impression. Now, as Ezekiel began this, doing this, and, you know, it probably takes him a number of days, maybe weeks, to get the thing all done. If he's as slow at working at models as Ben and I are, we've got this Mack truck we've been working on for how many years now that we seem to do it, and then we put it away, and dust gets on it. We blow the dust off, and we work. I'm sure he wasn't as slow as we are, though. The Lord's probably keeping him busy there. But as he began to do this, obviously it wouldn't take long before the word would spread. Hey, you hear what Ezekiel Ben Buzai is doing? Come on over and look. Weird. And so crowds are beginning to gather, and people are watching this now. And stories of life in prisoner of war camps in World War II, for example, verify how quickly news can spread like wildfire among thousands of people. You know, like, we're getting out, or we're not getting out, or something like that. I mean, it goes fast in a closed culture or society like that. So this is, in a sense, like charades, but it's serious charades. The people would be watching him, and remember, he's not saying a word. He's just doing it. He's just working away there, and they're gathering around. He's probably basically ignoring them. And so here they are watching it and wondering, now what in the world is the guy doing? They're probably discussing and considering the symbolism here and the significance of this silent, strange drama of the prophet. Because remember, this was the people of God. They knew about symbols, and they knew about prophecies, and they knew about actions. I mean, this was part of their culture. So it wasn't as odd as if, you know, one of us went out on 4th and Pike and did something like that. I mean, it's a whole different scenario. Okay? There are other symbolic actions by other prophets in the Bible as well. The prophet Ahijah tore Jeroboam's brand new garment into 12 pieces, just got it from Habib the tailor, and now he rips it into a dozen pieces, gives 10 of them to Jeroboam, and then, of course, he tells them, this was a lousy garment, and I wanted to show you how easily it would be torn. No, he didn't tell them that. He told them that 10 of the tribes are going to be given to you and 2 for Judah. 1 Kings chapter 11, verse 30. One of Jeroboam once said, why didn't you just tell me? I have to walk home naked. Semi. Also, the false prophet, Zedekiah, made horns of iron, and he prophesied that Israel and Judah would push Syria with them. Now, that was a false prophecy. It was from a false prophet. But it shows again that they would do these symbolic actions. Horns meaning strength, power. 1 Kings 22:11. Elisha told King Joash of Israel to shoot an arrow out a window, because that was going to symbolize their victory over Syria in Aphek. Then he told him to take some arrows and to smite the ground, hit the ground with them. And the point was going to be that the intensity with which he smote the ground with them would indicate the extent of their victory over the Syrians. And so the king was rather passive. Flop, slap, slap, 3 times. And Elisha got really upset in the spirit and said, now you're only going to have partial victory. You could have had total victory, permanent victory over the enemy. Boy, maybe that tells us something about demon deliverance. There could be something there, I don't know. With the 2 Kings chapter 13, verse 14 and following. Also, Isaiah went without his outer garments and without his sandals for 3 years. Well, he must have got some humongous calluses on his feet, huh? To portray the captivity of Egypt by Assyria. Isaiah chapter 20, verse 1 and following. The prophet Jeremiah did a number of these. One time he made a linen belt in chapter 13. Another time he took a potter's vessel and he broke it in front of the people, and he was showing how the nations were going to be shattered in judgment because of their sin, chapter 19. Another time he took ropes and oxen yokes, made them and he hung them around his neck, showing that various nations were going to be in subjection, to the yoke of subjection under Babylon, chapter 27, verse 2. And we even have one New Testament, New Covenant example. But remember, it's still the same basic society, isn't it? And so that's why you could understand it still being done. The prophet Agabus tied his own hands and his own feet with Paul's belt, saying, "Thus saith the Lord, the owner of it is going to go bound likewise to Jerusalem." Prophetic action, coupled with words in this case. Acts chapter 21, verse 10 and following. I think perhaps we're learning a little bit more about the nature of portraying things symbolically through the dance. I feel that actions in the dance, they all mean something. Now, they're a language without words, so there's no sense trying to sit down and create a lexicon, you know, giving the definition and meaning of every gesture and movement. But what I'm saying is somehow our spirit is able to express anything from surrender to the Lord, to victory over demons, to rejoicing over salvation, to being a part of the bride of Christ, one with another and part of the bride of Christ and so forth, through what the spirit is able to express freely through the body when the soul is out of the way for change. And demons are out of the way for a change. Verse 4. Lie also upon thy left side, and lay the iniquity of the house of Israel upon it. According to the number of the days that thou shalt lie upon it, thou shalt bear their iniquity. Okay, so first he played the part of Yahweh besieging the people in Jerusalem. Now he's to reverse the roles and to play the part of the people. Suffering because of their sins. And that's why he's lying down, because lying speaks of suffering and defeat rather than standing. I think that also, though, in a great messianic type, he's portraying Jesus Christ, our sin bearer, who took our sins upon himself. Now, first he lies on the left side, and for Israel, that is to stand for Israel. And then we're going to see in verse 5, he's laid upon him the years of their iniquity according to the number of the days. So there's going to be a parallel here in the figure. Then verse 6, when he's done that, he turns over on his right side. And on his right side, he'll be standing for the iniquity of the house of Judah. And he does that for 40 days. So first on the left, then on the right. The left for Israel, the right for Judah. Now, left is the less honorable direction in the Hebrew mind, for a number of reasons. I don't really want to get into them, but it's the left less honorable. Right is the more honorable. And so Israel, which is of course already in captivity, they were so wicked they went before Judah did, they're the less honorable, and they're going to be in captivity longer. So left side first for Israel, then the right side for Judah. And I wouldn't doubt it if he faced... I wouldn't doubt it if he positioned his body so that when he was laying on his left side, he would be facing the north, because that's the direction that Israel went captive into, north through Israel, then over to Assyria and Media and so forth. And I wouldn't doubt it if, not only that, Israel was north of Judah, so north applying to Israel. And I wouldn't doubt it if when he turned over on his right side, then, of course, this would happen automatically if he was facing other, that he'd be facing south now, representing Judah. Now, verse 5, he says, "For I have laid upon you the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days. So shall you bear the iniquity of the house of Israel." Now, there's a lot in here. It's going to take us some time to get through it all, but just some overall comments first. Notice he says, I've laying it upon you. Not that he actually became a sin bearer. Remember, Jesus is the only efficacious death, and he's not even dying here. And if he did, he couldn't even atone for his own sins, let alone theirs. But he means in the symbol, in the symbolic action, you're representing them sufferings. And I'm going to lay upon you the number of their iniquity. But he stands as such a perfect type of Christ, who did indeed take our iniquity and bear our iniquity upon himself. And remember, he's doing this because he can't talk, or he's not going to be talking to them. So he's going to show God battling them and them suffering for their iniquity, not just in the siege and captivity of Jerusalem, but for years, their captivities. Now, here we have a figure, 390 days, a little over a year. We have 365 days for a year, so we've got a year and 25 days, a year and almost a month, so almost 13 months. Now, somehow, this has to symbolize a 390-year period, because he says, I've laid upon you the years of their iniquity, according to the number of the days, 390 days. Obviously, he couldn't lay there for 390 years. He didn't have that many years to live, so he had to pick a day for a year. So every day that he laid on his left side represented a year of Israel's iniquity. But now the fun is trying to figure out what this 390-year period of, when this 390-year period of iniquity was in the northern kingdom. When did it begin? When did it end? God doesn't tell us anything. He just lays it out there, and then we get out our calculators and stopwatches and rulers and Bibles and concordances and try to figure it out. And we're going to deal with this when we get into the next verse here. Verse 6, and when you have accomplished them, lie again on your right side, and you shall bear the iniquity of the house of Judah 40 days. I have appointed thee each day for a year. So again, makes it very clear that each day is representing, that he's laying on his side is representing a year of their time, of their iniquity. And that's not an uncommon device in God's economy, to have a day standing for a year. For example, when Moses sent the spies in, they spied out from the wilderness, they spied out Canaan 40 days. And then when they came back with the evil report, and the people believed the evil report instead of the report of faith, God says, all right, you're going to wander for 40 years, a year for a day, in the wilderness, and then you're going to die. Numbers chapter 14 and verse 34. After the number of the days in which you searched the land, even 40 days, each day for a year you shall bear your iniquities, even 40 years, and you shall know my breach of promise. That is, you shall know what it means to break the promise of God, or your promise to God, that you'd, all that the Lord has spoken we would do. So now we get down to it. What do the 390 years for Israel and the 40 years for Judah represent? And here's some possibilities. I'm going to give you about six for Israel. Okay, and these are just, we're just talking now. First of all, the 390, some feel that it represents the time from the divided kingdom, beginning of the divided kingdom. Remember, after Solomon died, the kingdom was divided. And Rehoboam became king in Judah, Jeroboam became king in Israel. And so some feel it represents from that time all the way down to the Babylonian captivity. From the time of Jeroboam, first king of the northern kingdom of Israel, to the Babylonian captivity. Now, if we take Usher's chronology, and that's the one that is the basis for the dates that you see in the margin of your King James Version, if we take that, it does come out to 390 years. From 975 B.C., to 585 B.C. 975 to 585 is 390 years. Now, there's a problem with that, though. A couple problems, I think. First of all, most modern conservative scholars do not accept Usher's chronology anymore, because he did not have some of the archaeological and historical evidence at his disposal that scholars today have to work with, and therefore his figures are not always accurate. Most scholars today give as the date of 931, and this is a pretty commonly agreed upon date, and it's based upon some pretty solid chronological data. 931 as when the kingdom divided. Now, 931 to 390, if we started at 931 then and worked for 390 years, it takes us down to 541 BC. Now, what happened in 541 BC? That wouldn't make any sense. Because remember, the captivity started in 605 and ended in 586, so 541 would be, 586, some 44 years. It would be about 44 years after the destruction of Jerusalem, and it would be about 5 years before the Jews returned back to the land. And there's really nothing that you can tie in with that. It's just a loose date. It really wouldn't make sense. Second possibility. This one, we just say, okay, why don't we take the destruction of Jerusalem and work backwards and add 390 years to it. So Jerusalem was destroyed in 586 BC. We add 390 years to that, and we get 976 BC. Now, we still have to ask ourselves, okay, great, what happened in 976 BC? Well, that would place us somewhere in David's reign. But I suppose someone could say, well, maybe that's when he committed adultery with Bathsheba, or killed Uriah, or numbered Israel, or did something, and maybe that he considered that to be the beginning of the iniquity of Judah, I mean, of Israel. Although, why would he pick that time? Why not Saul, who was the first king of Israel? I mean, if David sinned, Saul really sinned. So what would be so significant about that in David's life? So again, it's not a real satisfying answer. Third possibility. By the way, there's two other problems that I didn't... There's one other problem with both of those possibilities that I didn't mention. And that'll make it two for the first one. I think I just mentioned... I said I was going to mention two and I mentioned one. But it applies to number two as well. And that is, he's lying on his side for the iniquity of the house of Israel. And the house of Israel is being contrasted with the house of Judah. But we're working with the fall of Jerusalem here, which is Judah. So what would that have to do with Israel? Israel was already gone into captivity by 722 BC. So that's another point that really doesn't fit. All right, let's work with 722 BC then, when Israel went captive. And this is number three. What happens if you add 390 years to that? Well, that yields a date of 1112 BC. That would put us probably during the time of the high priest Eli. Now, there were sins. He neglected to raise his sons right in the ways of the Lord. And there were sins at Shiloh where the ark and the tabernacle were. And God allowed judgment on Eli and judgment on the people and the ark to go into captivity for a while and so forth. But again, were the sins and the iniquities in the reign of Eli so outstandingly significant above the sins of the period of the judges before him and the sins of the kings of Israel after him, that would be a real starting point for, you know, the iniquity of Israel? And to me, that's a real debatable question. Or to say that it is would be a debatable statement, is what I'm trying to say. Now, what if we say, okay, let's start it with the kings of Israel, because that was a sin asking for a king, wasn't it? So let's, and rejecting God through the theocratic kingdom of the judges. And he says in a real compact commentary on their history of the kings in the Psalms, he says, I gave a king in my anger, and I took him away in my wrath. So, if we start with the monarchy under Saul, and the beginning of his reign is pretty much generally agreed upon today as being 1050 BC. Now we deduct 390 years, the years of the iniquity of Israel, and that would bring us down to 660 BC, which again has no significance biblically as being anything happening or ending or anything at that time. That just, you know, it's just a date. Before Judah going into captivity, and it's after Israel going into captivity, because remember, their date's still 722, so the 660 can't fit either. Now, some of the scholars, this is point number five, opt for the reading of the Septuagint in this verse. And the Septuagint, which varies a lot in the numbers, gives a reading of 190 years. However, that doesn't really solve the problem. You can play with the figure 190, just as much as you can 390, and you're still going to be baffled. Besides, there's no reason here to reject the reading of the Masoretic text and opt for the reading of a version. Now, some of the commentators say this is only supposed to be understood symbolically. And here's the reasoning they give. First of all, they talk about Judah's 40 years. They say the reason that God picked the number 40 is because, according to the law, if a person was to be beaten, the maximum number of stripes that you could lay upon him was 40. And so 40 would speak of punishment for disobedience. Deuteronomy 25 and verse 3. So you say, well, where does the 390 come in then? Well, the Jews, by the time of Jesus' day at least, if not before, had decided that they were only going to lay a maximum of 39 stripes on anybody to make sure that they wouldn't make a mistake and go over 40. And so that's the 40 save one that you see in the New Testament. So, and 390 is 39 times 10. And so Israel, or the northern kingdom, consisted of 10 tribes, and God was going to give them their punishment, 39 stripes times 10, which is 390. However, the problem with this one, the 40 could make sense if you're going to start talking about, you know, symbolism. But the problem with the 390 or 39 figure is that God never ordained the 39 figure. The Jews, the Pharisees, modified the law and said 39's safer. Besides that, to be consistent with that interpretation, since you're going to divide the number by the number of tribes, 39 divided by 10, then you better take the then you better take 39 instead of 40 for Judah and divide it by 2 or 3 tribes, depending on whether you're looking at Judah and Benjamin, or Judah, Benjamin, and Levi, or 40 divided by 2 or 3. And why would he give 39 to Israel and 40 to Judah? If anything, it would be the other way around, looking at the nature of the two kingdoms. Now, what have they said about the 40 years for Judah? I haven't gotten any conclusions yet. I haven't given you any. We're just picking at possibilities. Well, the southern kingdom of Judah, the most wicked king in all of Judah, according to the statements of the historical books, was who? Manasseh. Manasseh did more evil than all the kings before him and those after him, it says. Now, Manasseh ruled 55 years, and he did evil in the sight of the Lord. Therefore, it says the Lord allowed him to be carried captive to Babylon. And this was before Babylon was even a world power. But to be carried captive to Babylon. But then, and this is the most amazing event, I think, in Manasseh's life, because it's so out of character. He prayed. What is this saying? Man's extremity is God's opportunity. You know, the rest of that saying goes, man's security, the devil's opportunity. So he prayed. And therefore God heard his prayer and brought him back to Jerusalem. And he did right by the Lord for a while, and he was restored to his kingdom as king. Now, where does 40 come in? Some speculate that the 40 years referred to the portion of his reign when he did evil, before the Lord allowed him to be carried away to Babylon, and that then he came back and reigned for 15 more years. Now, the problem there, obviously, is that it's speculation. Number one, you have to speculate that it's the reign of Manasseh that God is considering to be Judah's real iniquity, not the only time they committed iniquity. And that's not too unreasonable a speculation if you're going to speculate, because their scriptures, Jeremiah talks about, because of the sins of Manasseh, you're going to go captive and so forth. He brought Baal worship into Judah, human sacrifice of children to the Moloch god, and various other terrible things. Scriptures here would be 2 Kings 21, verses 1 through 3 and verse 16. 2 Chronicles 33, verses 1, 2, 7, 8 through 13, and 15. Now here's a second possibility for the meaning of Judas 40 years. Jeremiah, the prophet, the older contemporary of Ezekiel, ministered for 40 years. That can be proven. Now, Jeremiah's ministry began in the 13th year of King Josiah's reign. Now, stay with me here. It's real easy to fall asleep in this kind of a presentation, but you try to stay with me. From that point, then, to the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple is 40 years. From the time that the prophet Jeremiah began to minister to them till the time when God allowed them to be destroyed, their nation, their city to be destroyed, and them to be carried away was 40 years. Now, and so there are indications that the 40-year period, there's a possibility that this 40-year period of Judah's iniquity terminated with the fall of Jerusalem. Just like I feel that Israel's 390-year iniquity had to terminate with the fall of Samaria. I don't see how it could go beyond that. I mean, not that they couldn't commit sin out there, you know, among the Goyim or the nations, but I feel that it's likely that it would end there with their judgment. So I think it's at least as likely that Judah's 40-year iniquity terminates with the fall of Jerusalem, the capital of Judah. And there are some verbal parallels here that I'm not in the Hebrew that I'm not going to take the time to bring out. Also, remember the number 40 is a number of testing and trial in the Bible. And I think there could be, he could be using it symbolically plus literally. You know, two can run parallel here. And I think that God, in Jeremiah's ministry, was giving Judah 40 more years. 40 last years, during which he brought his word through the prophet and through other prophets, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, and then Ezekiel and Daniel in captivity. However, Judah rejected Jeremiah's ministry almost totally, thereby failing the very last test that God was going to give them, the last opportunity. And so this was their iniquity. Not in the sense that it was the only iniquity they ever committed, but it was, you might say, the straw that broke the camel's back. God gave them one last chance, and they blew it. Now, if you haven't taken the book of Jeremiah, okay, most of you remember his message, how that in the earlier part of his ministry, his message held out hope for Judah, didn't it? That if they would repent, God would not send Babylon against them. For example, Jeremiah 7, verses 3 and 7. He says, if you amend your ways, you will dwell in the land forever. But then, toward the end of his ministry, when it became clear that Judah was not going to hearken to God, God caused Jeremiah's message to turn a little bit, a lot. And no longer did he hold out any hope of deliverance for the people. Rather, he decreed that Babylon would indeed take Judah, and so now you just better not fight him or resist him or you're going to die. You just go into captivity, you know, take your licks, and you'll come back after 70 years. With this, Jeremiah 21, verses 4 through 10, where it says, Babylon will smite Judah, therefore submit to Babylon, don't resist him. Now, you say, well, this seems to be singling out Jeremiah. I know it. And Jeremiah wasn't the only prophet of God whose words Judah had rejected. There was a whole line of them, and there were contemporaries to Jeremiah. However, Jeremiah's ministry might be analogous to Christ's parable about digging around and fertilizing the tree of Israel for one more year in hopes that it would bear fruit. Luke chapter 13, verses 6 through 9. And with this, I want to read 2 Chronicles 36, verses 12 16 and 17. 2 Chronicles 36, 12, 16, and 17. There it says, and remember how Chronicles tends to be kind of a commentary from a spiritual viewpoint on what is more presented from a factual standpoint in Kings. It gives you more the spiritual aspect, why, the whys, the wherefores. So verse 12, it basically tells us that Zedekiah would not humble himself before Jeremiah. Zedekiah would be the last king of Judah. And it says in verse 16 that these Jews mocked the messengers of God. They despised his words. They misused his prophets until the wrath of the Lord arose against his people till there was no remedy. And then verse 17, it says, therefore he brought the Chaldees against them, the Babylonians. So that's a possibility, that it would refer then to the last 40 years of Judah's national existence from 526 or 527 to 586. Now, my conclusion is that we don't have enough data, and I'd have suspected that this was coming, to pin down exactly what either one of these two periods, when they start and when they end for Israel and Judah, 390 and 40 years. Now, that's not the only place in the Bible you've got that kind of a thing to deal with. Some of these other prophetic chronologies get pretty hairy, if you've ever studied them. The 70 weeks of Daniel, and the 1290 days, and the 1335 days of Daniel chapter 12, verses 11 and following. I mean, these can get pretty difficult. I'm not saying we don't maybe have the currently have the proper interpretation for these. Maybe we do. Maybe we don't. But they can be very difficult. So sometimes you've got to be content to list all the possibilities, and there may be others that I haven't listed, and then be also content with the fact that the original hearers and readers of these words probably knew what the points of reference were, although maybe they didn't. Maybe it's for the end of time for somebody to know, but they probably did in their time, because they know their history better than we do. We have to look back through ancient archives and Assyrian eponym lists and cuneiform tablets and biblical references and archaeological finds and to try to put all this mishmash together and somehow reconstruct their history. And believe me, there's a lot of gaps. And therefore, there's need for speculation. And there's another possibility here that could put this in a whole different light. This period, 390 years, 40 years, rather than representing the time in which during which they sinned, could represent the time during which they're going to be punished. They shall bear their iniquity, I think it says. Or it says, lay the iniquity of them. According to the number of the days, they shall bear their iniquity. And so it could be saying that that's how long they're going to be judged, not that's how long they sinned. And therefore, both figures could point to future fulfillments. And they may not refer to any historical period already fulfilled in Israel or in Judah as a nation. Because look at verse 13. He says, even thus shall the children of Israel eat their defiled bread among the Gentiles, where I will drive them, among the nations. And look at Judah's punishment in verses 16 and 17. It talks about a famine, eating bread by weight, drinking water by measure with astonishment, and consume away with their iniquity. See, this didn't necessarily happen right in Ezekiel's day, or even immediately after that, or before that. Could have happened at AD 70 with the Jews. Could happen at the Battle of Armageddon. Could happen in the future sometime. So it may not be fulfilled. And that's some of the most difficult prophecies to wrestle with, is those that we think have been fulfilled. And so we try to shoehorn something in. But that's exactly what you have to do with it, because it hasn't been fulfilled. I can give you some places in the Minor Prophets that have no less than 40 different possible interpretations that have been listed by the commentators, about 8 shepherds and 7 principal men being raised against them. There's just a number of them that are really difficult. All right. Now, what about looking at it from the natural standpoint for a moment? And this will be our... Did the last bell ring yet? Okay, I'll close with this remark. Did Ezekiel literally lie 24 hours a day on his left side for 13 months and on his right side for over a month, for 40 days? I say no. Undoubtedly, Ezekiel did not lie constantly in this manner, but probably for a portion of each day. And when the day was over and or the spectators left, I believe that God allowed him to get up, return to his house, and to the more normal mode of life. I don't believe there would have been anything accomplished by him laying there continually. He had to get up to do things that God commanded him to do. Make this bread of affliction we're going to see here later in chapter 4. He can't do that laying on his side, verse 9 and following. You know, had to use the restroom. I mean, there's just the normal functions of life that had to be accomplished. Now, the liberals say that Ezekiel had epilepsy or catalepsy, and that's why he's laying there. And I'm not even gonna stoop to rebuttal that one. So, we'll see you next week.